This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to David Margowick. He's the author of When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. It's really good to have you here, David. How are you?
Well, I'm very well, David, and I'm happy to see you again after 50-something years. We both changed, but we're both still going strong.
And hopefully change for the better.
Yeah, right. We'll change for the grayer anyway.
Yeah, right. Well, that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
I think. So, well, what's interesting to me, I mean, I have many reasons to be interested in this book, but I think aside from my personal reasons, I think the story of early television in America is really underappreciated. I'm guessing that a lot of people don't even know that television was live when it first began.
I'm guessing that there are lots of people out there who've never thought that television had to be invented. You know, I mean, television is such a part of the firmament, you know, is such a part of our culture that it's very hard to for many people to imagine a time without it. And, you know, television in its early stages and its growing pains and its primitive iteration at the very beginning and all of that is really quite unimaginable to lots of people. And I think, you know, insufficiently studied and recorded and appreciated. And I really felt as if I was walking on virgin territory in a way in much of what I did in this book. There are all kinds of holes that I think I had to fill because no one really had been there before. I mean, you know, for starters, I don't think that anybody had watched all of Sid Caesar's shows for 60 years. And that's notwithstanding the fact that everybody's always talking about how great they were and how important he was. But no one ever sat down really and watched them all systematically in the way that I felt I had to do in order to write about the guy.
So the book, in a way, opens, or at least kind of introduces Sid, your interest in Sid, kind of dating to around 2000. When you were at the Alan King Jewish Comedy Award, when he was given that award. And at that time, so 2000, he would have been 78 years old.
Yeah, right. Right. And I was there really by accident. He was the second or the third winner of the Alan King Award for comedy, given by this Jewish group since gone defunct. And Carl Reiner was the second, and Alan King was the first. And veterans of that era would have wondered why Carl was given the award before Sid, because Sid made Carl, among many other people. Sid discovered Carl Reiner. So that was another of his progeny. But yes, it's true that I went to this dinner just out of curiosity. I knew that Sid Caesar was famous, and people talked very admiringly of him and his influence. But I had never, you know, as you and I were discussing before, we hadn't grown up watching him because it's hard to believe, but we were too young to have taken him in the first time around. And if you didn't watch him live, you really didn't know him because later on his shows were not syndicated. They weren't sitcoms and they really didn't lend themselves to neat little half hour chunks. So after his decade or so on the air, he pretty much disappeared and he became kind of a cult figure until YouTube came along and then all the comedy groupies could watch him again. So, you know, I knew he was famous for being famous, but I didn't know why. And I kind of was curious about what all the fuss was about him. And so I went to this dinner and there he was. Mel Brooks was introducing him. Mel Brooks was the speaker that night. I think Mel Brooks was the featured attraction in a way, because Mel Brooks was, you know, riding high and people knew him a lot better than they knew Sid Caesar, even though Sid Caesar made Mel Brooks. You know, Mel Brooks often said, you know, no Sid Caesar, no Mel Brooks. And Mel recognized his debt to Sid. And so, you know, when he had the chance to be the keynote speaker for the Sid Caesar winning this award, there he was. And he spoke about Sid in the same reverential way that everybody who worked with him did. And they showed a couple of clippings from the old show, not representative clippings, because there wasn't even enough knowledge to pick out the right sketches. I mean, they didn't ask anybody, what are the sketches that we need to show? That's how obscure Sid, you know, his Sid was well known to everybody over a certain age in that audience and completely unknown to people like me who hadn't grown up watching him. And so I thought, there is a good story here. And there was a better story when you saw how diminished Sid was from the way he had looked in his heyday. You know, he was sort of a decrepit old guy, even though he was not all, it's as you say, he was 78 and he lived into his 90s. But he was very slight and kind of beleaguered, anemic looking. He'd gone on a physical fitness tear after he went clean and stopped drinking and popping pills. And he'd shrunken from his former robust self, which made it even harder to imagine what he had been. And when he got up to speak, he really didn't know what to say, and he lapsed into his famous double talk where he speaks gibberish and mock German or mock Italian or mock Japanese. And again, I mean, it just triggered in me. I recognized that there were a couple of great stories here. You know, one was, who was this man and why was he so important? And then what the hell happened to him? So there was a story about him going up and really being the biggest man in television comedy and the most influential man in television comedy. And then what the hell happened to Sid Caesar? Now, that was the year 2000. And I guess I'm a little bit slow because it wasn't until the year 2008 that I started the book.
But you were able to talk to Sid, which I thought was must have been pretty interesting, despite, you know, whatever the condition he was in at that time.
Yeah, I did talk to him. I figured I better get to him pretty quickly. So I talked to him shortly after I signed up for the book and before I even knew which questions to ask him. I went over to his house in the Truesdale section of Beverly Hills, which you will know, north of Sunset. And it was like a time capsule. You know, it was as if nobody had opened a window. It was like something a little bit out of Sunset Boulevard. And when people went up to see Sid, there'd always be wisecracks about Norma Desmond. And I spoke to him on two consecutive days. And the interesting thing from a journalistic standpoint was that historically, in his bad days, in his years in the wilderness, after he went off the air, but before he went clean, he would make periodic appearances on TV on the shows of sympathetic disciples of his who were trying to keep him up, prop him up, keep him out there, give him a chance to perform, take care of him, pay their debt to him, which they all felt. People like Carol Burnett or Dick Cavett or Johnny Carson or Jackie Gleason, all of these people recognized Sid's greatness. Mel Brooks, you know, many of them gave Sid a chance to sort of keep his face out there. And that was another, you know, another touching part of the story. But the point that I was going to make was that in his wilderness years, Sid had always had trouble talking, which is an odd problem for a comic to have. He was shy and he was maladroit and he couldn't play himself. He was very awkward. He couldn't do introductions on the show. They had to get Hugh Downs in there to introduce people because Sid would stammer when it was all live television, as you say, David. And Sid, you know, Sid couldn't perform himself as himself, but he did double talk, he did pantomime, he did incredible character portrayals. He could do everybody but himself. And when he talked either then or later, when he was out in the wilderness, it was really, he was a tough guy to interview. And the people who tried to interview him had to sort of prop him up. And I remember like Dick Cavett had him on and, you know, Dick Cavett would give him openings like, what would they say about your latest project in Germany? And then, you know, Sid would be able to go into his German double talk. And that was always a kind of life raft for him. And so the interesting thing was that by the time I got to him, in 2008, so you can do the, he was in his 80s at that point, Sid was more articulate than he had been in decades. I mean, Sid got more articulate the older he got, more eloquent, really, eloquent for the first time in his life. And so I had a good interview with him, you know, and I learned a lot from him, and he said a lot of things in those two interviews on consecutive days that I had with him that I had never heard him say before. And when I went back to listen to it, even though I didn't know enough about him to ask all the questions that I should have, I was struck by how good his answers were and how thoughtful his answers were and how original his answers were. And I got great pleasure from that. I also got pleasure from showing him, playing for him a couple of his most famous sketches and seeing this decrepit old guy who was even more decrepit than when I saw him at that awards dinner, watching himself as this robust young man from the 1950s and watching two of his most famous sketches, the takeoff on This Is Your Life, which I say is the longest laugh in the history of television to this day. Really an amazing, no one's ever contradicted me on that. There's that very famous sketch, all done on live TV, and then the famous sketch where he's playing the man that you think is a German general being dressed by his valet, Howard Morris. Another incredible tour de force with a very, very poignant and powerful ending that I won't give away, but you can see it on YouTube. And I had a good interview with him. And when I went back and listened to it again, he told the story about how he knew that he had really arrived. You know, I said to him, "You were the man that every Jewish family in the country was following and taking pride in quelling over and living vicariously through." And he had a laugh over that. And he was making $25,000 a week in 1954 dollars, $25,000 a show, you know, and he could have whatever he wanted. And everybody was living vicariously through the jewelry that he wore and the limousines that he bought and was squired around in, and the house that he lived in on Long Island, and everybody was living through him. And he had a laugh about that. And then when he knew he'd really arrived was when he could go into Barney Greengrass and he could get as much sturgeon as he wanted, even though it was $5 a pound, he could get as much of it as he wanted. And I just love that story. And P.S. sturgeon is $72 a pound now. But I love that story enough that when it came time to have my book party last fall, we had it at Barney Greengrass in his honor. And I played that portion of the interview where he talks about what Barney Greengrass's sturgeon meant to him. That's a very long-winded answer.
No, that's pretty good. Well, what's interesting to me, of course, is that, as you alluded to, you did not grow up watching Sid Caesar, so that whatever you had to do to learn about him was either secondhand from talking to people or watching the kinescopes, which is the only, they did record all of these shows. Now, not every show that existed in that era was recorded assiduously.
Right, no, that's right.
Many of them are gone.
Many of them are gone, right.
Sids were collected. I think you said, I can't remember whether it was Sid had them in a, like in his pool house or something.
Yes. Well, I had a lot of homework to do when I started this book because, you know, Sid was on, you know, a total of 8 or 9 years, really, between the three shows, starting with the Admiral Broadway Review in the first season, and then 4.5 years of Your Show of Shows and 3 years of Caesar's Hour. And these were all spread out in various places. Most of them, by far the largest collection, is at the Paley Center in New York. So I spent a lot of time there watching the various shows, some of which were digitized and others were on tape. And also the Library of Congress had some of them, and Sid had some of them. Sid's collection included most of Caesar's Hour, which was his own show, rather than, unlike Your Show of Shows and the Admiral Broadway Review, which were produced by Max Liebman, and Max Liebman always made sure there were copies of those. So I had to round up those, and that took some doing and some traveling. But I think that in the end, I probably watched 85 or 90% of the shows. I did not watch every moment of every show because there were a lot of repeat performances. I mean, they didn't slip in tape. These shows were done live. So if they were going to repeat a segment, they had to perform it all over again. And there were a lot of those where I didn't have to watch them more than once. And it was uncanny how they managed to reproduce them almost word for word, the earlier performances. And then, you know, there was a lot of jumping and dancing, as Sid referred to it, you know, jumping and screaming. Sid did the comedy for his shows, but the shows weren't exclusively comedy. There was dance, there was music, you know, there was singing, there were, you know, opera performances. It was kind of a highbrow show. All of his shows were sort of for an elite Northeastern audience, which was where television was still concentrated in these early days. And a lot of that stuff, I watched it, but I didn't have to watch it because that was not the comedic element in the programs. That was a chance to sort of broaden the audience a little bit and give the comedians a chance to catch their breath between their performances. So I didn't watch every minute of every show, but I tracked down almost all of the shows and watched almost all of the comedy.
Yeah, I think we should probably talk a little bit about what it was like at the beginning in live TV, because I think it's hard for people today to understand what they were doing, which was, you know, they were creating they were trying to figure out how television would work. And they, you know, the sort of obvious thing to do was to adapt performance modes that had already existed and that people were familiar with. So the early shows that Sid was involved with were kind of, as you just described, a mixture, you know, like a
variety shows.
Variety show.
Yeah.
You know, think about the comedy and all of the writing that goes into that. That had to all be done every week, over and over again, from start to finish. Pretty intense work. The only thing that's equivalent to it today, obviously, is Saturday Night Live, which you do allude to in the book, knowing that Saturday Night Live is not it's not quite the same thing, but it is, it gives you a similar sensibility of what it would be like to create one of those hour-long shows in the early 50s. But in that period, in the early 50s, no one knew what was going to work. They had to figure it out on the fly.
That's right. And I think that Saturday Night Live is the closest descendant to what Sid Caesar was doing, but it's unfair to Sid to compare the shows because, you know, your show of shows was a much more rigorous production than Saturday Night Live. There was no sloppiness. Sloppiness was not sort of, and screw-ups were not built in, baked into the performances and a cause for laughs. There was very little ad-libbing. I mean, there's some great ad-libbing when the occasions called for it, but by and large, they stuck to their scripts. They showed enormous discipline. There was no cheating. As I say, you know, everything was live. They didn't slip in a taped performance. I mean, I gather that a lot of Saturday Night Live, or at least a substantial portion of it, isn't necessarily live. And all of Sid's shows were live. And so there was a kind of brinksmanship in these shows that I think has never existed in television since. And doing it week after week for 90 minutes is really an astonishing accomplishment. One of Sid's writers said it was like walking, you know, tightrope walking across Niagara Falls week after week after week. And, you know, as soon as they finished one week, they already had to start thinking about the next one. In the earliest stages of television, you're right, David, that they basically just took a stage show and with one camera and showed it. But they quickly realized that television was a much more intimate medium than that, and they needed close-ups, and you couldn't reduce a live performance, you know, in a live theatrical performance to a 6 or 8 inch television screen. You needed to home in on it and get faces in there and everything. There was an intimacy to television and the very mechanics of television to which these comedians had to adapt. And that Sid did better than anyone, you know, in sketch comedy and that sort of thing, enacting these mini dramas and everything. you know, and focusing in on the faces and doing the more intricate camera work and all of that. Nobody rivaled Sid in that regard. And that, you know, that sketch, the takeoff on This Is Your Life that I mentioned before, is a prime example of that. I mean, that was filmed live in the audience at the Center Theater, since torn down, in Rockefeller Center. And the cameras follow Sid as he's running around. The cameras were the size of Volkswagens then, but the cameras managed to follow Sid around as he ran up on the stage and ran down, trying to keep from having to be selected for This Is Your, you know, in the imitation This Is Your Life show. And, you know, I mean, Sid was known for having the best technicians, and Sid did by far the most dramatic television, which was why it lasted. I mean, the novelty for shows like Milton Berle was the great first comedic success on TV, and that was really warmed over stuff. Sid was the first creation of television, the first true television comic. As I say in the book, also the first great casualty of television, because television ate him alive over the 8 or 9 years that he was doing this live stuff. He was fueled by alcohol to keep him going and pills to knock him out at the end of the day and the end of the week. And it just ate him up. Mel Brooks said, you could see the brain cells dying in him. And if you watch his performances, one of the great paradoxes of the show, of Caesar's shows, is that the raw energy at the beginning is more impressive than it is at the end, because these guys were really devising a medium, as you say, in real time. And it got more polished. The writing got more polished. The technical stuff got more polished. Sid's famous writer's room of lore, the one that's depicted in My Favorite Year and Laughter on the 23rd Floor, again, not very faithfully, that was not on your show of shows. That was on Caesar's Hour. That was when Larry Gelbart and Mel Brooks and Neil Simon were all working together in the same room. I mean, really just an extraordinary thing. But the interesting thing is that while the scripts were better and much more intricate and clever later on in Caesar's run, Caesar himself was gradually falling apart. It was never commented on in the press, but if you watch the shows closely, you can see his performances slipping. And that was when Carl Reiner, who really held the show together, and Howard Morris, his second and third bananas, were really keeping the show going and keeping Caesar on track.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've thought about the shortness of time in a way. You know, it obviously when they were living it was not short. But if you look back on it, 8 or 9, 10 years basically of this creativity and popularity, which quickly then ended. You know, and it's almost as if you sort of alluded to this earlier too, that when they started, it was kind of a Northeastern highbrow version of comedy influenced by New York Jewish culture, vaudeville, the history of comedy adapted to this new medium. And by the time that first period was done, which gets you to the mid-50s, late-50s, both the medium had changed, but also the audience had changed.
That's right. And the technology had changed and the cost structure had changed, so that putting on a live variety show every week was incredibly expensive. And it was much cheaper and easier on everybody to do filmed sitcoms. And that, you know, hence Bilko and I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners came on, and other mediocre sitcoms long since forgotten, but they were much more manageable and much cheaper, and advertisers liked them better, and they were easier on the writers and the performers. And that was something that Caesar wasn't interested in doing. He thought that was a very confining format, and he didn't adapt. He refused to do that kind of thing, and there's considerable question as to whether or not he would have been able to, even if he wanted to. So, you don't see him. You see Carl Reiner going off and doing the Dick Van Dyke Show, but Sid never made that move. And at the same time that was going on, and Westerns were coming on, and quiz shows were coming on, and all of them were easier than these very, very complicated and expensive variety shows to do, the audience was changing. And television was spreading by a kind of capillary action across the country, like one of those old documentaries about the Iron Curtain where communism is spreading all over Europe. You can see the reach of television extending out to the hinterlands, and the television audience was changing, and it was becoming less sophisticated. It was becoming simpler in its wants. One of the great paradoxes in early television is that people like Pat Weaver, who I mentioned before, the early architects of television, thought that television was going to smarten everybody up and thought that television would unify the country in a way, that television would educate and remove the distinction between educated and uneducated, between large city and small town, between what we would now call blue and red states. Television would homogenize the country. And that, you know, that was beyond even television's powers to do. So in the smaller communities, they didn't cotton to Sid Caesar. They thought Sid was kind of obnoxious and judging them in a way and talking over their heads. And here he was doing takeoffs of Japanese movies and The Bicycle Thief and Grand Illusion. They didn't know from these movies They didn't care about that kind of thing, and they resented Sid Caesar. They wanted something simpler than that. And in a kind of choreography that every writer, you know, sort of longs for, but can't arrange himself, it so happened that, you know, Sid went up against in his final season on television Lawrence Welk. And nothing, Lawrence Welk on ABC, which, you know, David, was the also-ran network. At that point, it was very much the third network, kind of the runt of the litter. And yet, there were lots of people who wanted to watch Lawrence Welk, and he knocked Sid Caesar off the air. And Sid recognized that he could see it happening. And one of the great discoveries that I made, I mean, it's more a matter of archaeology than brilliance on my part, but in watching these old shows, you uncover the three satires that Sid did on the Lawrence Welk show. I mean, Sid normally only did a satire once, and Sid was very gentle in his humor. Sid was not, this is a pun, and I don't mean this to be a pun, but Sid was not vicious. Sid was very careful and didn't want to offend anybody and didn't punch down. But when Lawrence Welk came along, he recognized, and his writers recognized, I remember Mel Brooks telling me about this, that they recognized that Lawrence Welk was an existential threat to them. And they did three absolutely brutal takedowns on Lawrence Welk, you know, depicting him in all of his corniness and all of the musicians, you know, with frozen smiles on their faces and everything. Just absolutely brutal takedowns. But it didn't do any good. And, you know, when the end of the last spring of Caesar's Hour was on the air, it was, you know, NBC wasn't interested in keeping it going anymore. In fact, there was even talk that NBC was going to reach out and try to get Lawrence Welk for itself. And that was the direction that television was going in. So after that, that was Sid's last regular show. And he had specials after that for a few years. That was when Woody Allen wrote for Sid. Woody Allen had a short bout with Sid. One of the specials that he did featured Woody Allen and Mel Brooks writing for Sid Caesar. That gives you some kind of an idea of what, you know, Caesar's star power was, that he could attract the two of them and Larry Gelbart too. And oddly enough, the show that Mel Brooks and Woody Allen wrote together for Sid was the first show where Caesar or the people around Caesar crossed a red line that Caesar vowed he would never cross, and had a laugh track. I mean, Caesar was a real purist, and he didn't want to cheat in any way, and he thought that there was something pernicious about a laugh track. But that was the first Caesar show that had one. And, you know, it always struck me that, you know, if television executives felt that Mel Brooks and Woody Allen needed a laugh track to get laughs, it sort of showed that maybe Sid Caesar's brand of comedy was a thing of the past and was fading away.
Well, in a way, it's similar to the era of the silent films, where stars couldn't adapt, especially the ones who couldn't, whose voices weren't appropriate for talkies. You have Sid kind of then becoming this lost figure, you know, where he's aside from the drinking, which was really harming his ability to function as a human being, much less as a comedian, his time was over. He didn't adapt. He wasn't able to be somebody other than he was, which doesn't mean that he was wrong. It just makes him a tragic figure.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, one of the ironies is that one of his most famous sketches called Aggravation Boulevard, sort of a takeoff of Sunset Boulevard, features the story about a silent film star, you know, being an enormous star and his undoing when the talkies came along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a scene in there where Carl Reiner, who is like, you know, the incredibly ambidextrous co-star who could play any kind of a role. And I think Carl Reiner's genius on the Sid Caesar programs is really unrivaled. I don't think he ever topped it. I think everybody connected with Caesar never topped the work that they did for him. And I think in a way that even goes for Mel Brooks. I mean, obviously he did great films and films that everybody knows, but the raw talent of Mel Brooks on the Caesar shows is there for everybody to see, and somebody should assemble it all, because the sketches that he wrote, the famous professor sketches where Sid is the German professor who's the authority on everything, you know, that was vintage Mel Brooks. But, it, you know, in the famous sketch that Caesar did about the story of the silent film star named Rex Handsome, and Rex Handsome, of course, is the most famous figure in films, but they're silent films. And in the middle of this takeoff, somebody brings in a headline of Variety and it says, "Films talk. The talkies have arrived." And Carl Reiner, the director, says, "Just think of it, Rex. The world can now hear you for the first time." And Sid says, at last, now they can hear me, you know, and you can see what his future is, that it just destroys him, you know. In a way, it became a kind of a harbinger of what happened in Sid's own career. The kind of brilliant live television that he was famous for was becoming a thing of the past. And Sid himself was becoming a thing of the past. And so he had this glorious 10-year run. And, you know, his tendrils reach everywhere, you know, through Larry Gelbart and Mel Brooks and Neil Simon and Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, all of these people who he influenced, Dick Cavett and Carol Burnett, Johnny Carson and Billy Crystal and Larry David and all of the people, Al Franken, all of the people who talk about their debt to Sid Caesar, Conan O'Brien, his influence was everywhere, but Sid himself disappeared.
Which is, I mean, it's both sad, but also pretty incredible how a short period of time could have so much influence and spread across a half a century or more, because it's ongoing. Each of those people has influenced other people, so that the work that Sid Caesar and Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and the early writers, Imogene, and the actors like Imogene Coca, it still lives on. You know, they've influenced generations.
I'm glad that you mentioned Imogene, because Imogene influenced all kinds of people, like Carol Burnett and a variety of women comics. All go back and cite Coca's brilliant work and Coca's incredible teamwork with Sid Caesar, the way that they complemented one another. Coca, you know, being this little itty bitty woman and Sid the starker, strong guy, and yet she stood up to him, and they had really one of the first domestic comedies. I mean, they were the Hickenloopers on your show of shows. And they were doing their thing before Lucy and Desi were doing theirs. And Sid had women writers before anybody else, really, even before Lucille Ball did. Lucille Callan was writing for Sid Caesar.
Although, as you point out, the women writers had a struggle.
Yeah, they didn't have it easy. It was a very, very chauvinistic world. Very, a lot of testosterone in that room, you know. And one of the things that I sort of took pride in setting the record straight on was that this was not always a happy world. I mean, these guys, I say in the book, and I think it's true, that all of these guys, none of them went to college. Okay. Virtually none of them. I mean, I think one or two of them might have gone a little bit, but they were all second generation Americans. They were all fighting for their livelihoods. They were all one step removed from the garment district. that was what they faced if they didn't make it in show business, and they knew it. And they were climbing over one another to please Sid Caesar. It was a dog-eat-dog world, and it was not, you know, it was not a happy world. It was a highly competitive, neurotic world, and a brutal world in a lot of ways. And so all of these sort of caramelized treatments of these people frolicking around and having a great time and all of that, that, you know, that's not the way that it was. It was a tough existence that they had for themselves, which was why they were all seeing shrinks. And Joe Stein told the story about coming in and hearing Sid, you know, vomiting in the bathroom. You know, Sid would come in every day and vomit, you know, just to sort of purge his breakfast. I mean, he was way ahead of his time in that. And, you know, and didn't understand why Sid was doing it. And the conversation turned to shrinks. And some of the other people said to Joe Stein, you know, who's your shrink? And he said, I don't have one. And they couldn't believe it. You know, Sid actually made a point of talking about shrinks, and Sid talked a lot publicly about his psychoanalysis. He was on the cover of Look magazine one week talking about what psychoanalysis had meant to him. So when I talk about, you know, there's a lot in the book. The book was originally written for a Jewish book series, and there's a lot in there about the Jewish side of Sid and Sid's comedy. It was never explicit. But, you know, there was never, like, very rarely was there any Yiddish used on any of Caesar's shows. They tried to sort of hide the explicitly Jewish stuff, but it's, you know, it's riddled with a Jewish sensibility.
Right. If you're Jewish, you recognize it very
much. Yeah, that's right. And Sid said the Jews knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I think, you know, since I grew up in that milieu, it's very familiar. That's the kind of high-powered, as you said, testosterone-driven, competitive comedy world, which is masking a lot of suffering at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. Richard Lewis said that, you know, he would watch Sid Caesar's shows and he would, you know, he would recognize, you know, his own family and all of the drama that was going on in the Caesar show, but his family didn't have the laughs. it was a very familiar world to him. And I think that's right. The other thing about the Caesar shows are absolutely obsessed with food. There are so many of the famous sketches that revolve around food. And I think that's also a core element in Jewish identity. Now, of course, it's a core element in human identity, too. It's pretty important to human beings generally. But I think it's absolutely integral to Jewish comedy. And I have a passage in the book where I sort of analyze that. Although the most intelligent thing comes from Mimi Sheridan. I asked her about this. And I said, you know, what is it about Jews and food? I mean, everybody has to eat and look at, you know, Italian cooking is obviously at the center of Italian culture. And, you know, look at the Sopranos. They're always eating and the Sopranos too. And she said, the Italians are just like the Jews about food, but without the panic. Without the panic.
Well
said. I think that captures it. That's,
yeah.
You know, that's really something that runs throughout Caesar's comedy and many of the most famous sketches. There's another great sketch, a boardroom meeting where Sid is playing this Macher executive and they all order lunch and he's the only one that doesn't get his sandwich. And he's just heartbroken and he doesn't know what to do. And Howard Morris is waving a pickle under his nose to make a point during an argument. And Sid is yapping at the pickle. And, you know, I think that, you know, it just highlights the absolute obsession with eating that's at the core of Jewish identity.
Well, I think it would be really good for people who read this book to then go out and cruise around YouTube.
Yeah.
Watch some of these episodes. I think you can go further, you know, like more recent times, not if you want to continue to explore Sid in later years, but I think that early years are really the best and the most powerful.
Yeah. And as you say, there's a lot of him on YouTube and you can get a very good flavor. It's too bad YouTube didn't happen sooner for Sid. Although, you know, there was a compilation called 10 from Your Show of Shows that was put out in the early 1970s, that introduced Sid to people like Conan O'Brien. You know, Conan O'Brien saw the This Is Your Life sketch on in that compilation. He was 10 years old, and afterwards he said to his father, "That's what I want to be." You know, it inspired a lot of younger comics too. Julian Schlossberg, who many of your viewers will know, was the one that put together 10 from your show of shows, and that introduced Sid to a whole new generation of people.
Right, and I never remember seeing that or even knowing about it.
Yeah, your father was derelict for not taking you to see it, you know.
Well, somebody
should have taken you to see it.
Yeah, probably at that point in time, I was busy with other things.
But yeah, right.
As we often were. Well, I want to thank you, David, for doing this. It's been great talking to you about When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. And I think it's a great book. I really appreciate your being on.
And I want to thank you for doing it, David. And it's nice really to talk to somebody who's thought as much about these days as you have and lived through some of them.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to David Margoyke.